Morning and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. Thank you all for being here on this wonderful winter wonderland morning. It was quite a surprise to me, I don't know about you, because I actually believed the forecasters who said the snow was going to come later in the day. But anyway, this is just a taste of it, and I'm glad you're all here and safely. And as a reward for coming out in the snow, everyone who's here gets double credit for coming today, okay? How about that? So, attendance. You get two check marks in the attendance box. So thank you very much. I will, while we have a minute, give you a little bit of a preview of the upcoming month. You will be seeing the March schedule on the website or getting it in your mailboxes. Next week, we'll be talking to three members of the Syracuse City School Board, along with Grant Rear from the Maxwell School, who will be moderating some Q&A, and then we'll open it up to questions from you, issues facing the school board, the school district. So that should be interesting, getting perspectives of those individual members. On March 11th, we'll be talking to Professor Deborah Freund. She'll be talking on the subject of controlling health care costs, which is, of course, she's an economist, and she's also a health policy expert. So think about what questions you would like to ask on March 11th of Professor Freund. She's looking forward to coming back to the roundtable. She hasn't been here in a few years. March 18th, another issue, a local issue, sales tax revenue. We will have Ken McChrisky from the city, Jim Rowley from the county, and County Legislator Jim Reinhart, who's the chair of the legislature and also of the sales tax committee that is looking at the next 10-year agreement for distribution of that 4% county sales tax that we pay. So that's an important issue for everyone here. That will be March 18th. And March 25th, we will be talking business with Randy Wolken of the Manufacturers Association. So that's the month coming up. Lots of things to study and get ready for. And again, welcome today to introduce today's guest speaker, one of our members, Tom Luck. Reverend Luck is pastor of St. Paul's Episcopal Church downtown. It's the one on the corner of Fayette and Montgomery. If you haven't been in the church, I highly recommend that you visit it. It's a beautiful edifice, and they do a lot of good things as well. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you. I should clarify, we are a church, but we call ourselves now St. Paul's Episcopal Cathedral, otherwise known as the Other Cathedral. It's a pleasure to be here, especially for this purpose today. Most of us go about our daily lives concerned about the tasks and people who are in our immediate worlds. Occasionally, an event such as Hurricane Katrina or the earthquake in Haiti draws our attention, concern, and compassion to people who suffer in ways that most of us truly cannot imagine. But there are people in the world who, on a daily basis, scan the earth, find those who are the most needy, and then ask, what can I do? Catherine Bertini is not only someone who has been asking, what can I do, for decades, she's answered it most profoundly. From 1989 to 1992, as Assistant Secretary of Agriculture, she served one out of six Americans through food assistance programs such as food stamps, WIC, and school lunches. Then from 1992 to 2002, she served as Executive Director of the World Food Program. With headquarters in Rome, it is the world's largest humanitarian agency, and Catherine oversaw 8,000 people in 82 countries and distributed food to 77 million people per year. Subsequent to her tenure at the World Food Program, she took on the not-so-small task of reforming the United Nations under Kofi Annan as Undersecretary General for Management. There she was responsible for management of the human, physical, and financial resources of the United Nations and security staff worldwide. Since 2005, she has been at the Maxwell School of Syracuse University, even while she also served as Senior Fellow to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, where she advised on the development of the foundation's new agricultural portfolio, which strives to improve the well-being of poor farmers in Africa and South Asia. A native of Syracuse, who attended Huntington School, Professor Bertini graduated from Cortland High School, Albany University, and has honorary doctorates from 10 universities, including McGill, American University of Rome, and the Slovak Agricultural University. She is a founding member of the Global Humanitarian Forum. I have been fortunate to attend the Maxwell School through their executive education program, and I had read all of the above before I took Professor Bertini's class on humanitarian action. But spending time with her in the classroom, not to mention a long bus ride to the United Nations headquarters in New York, I can also tell you that Catherine is also one of the most sincere, humble, and down-to-earth people I have ever known. It is my honor and privilege to introduce to you Professor Catherine Bertini.
Thank you very much, Reverend Luck. And I have to say to the people, the hearty Central New Yorkers who came today, and to those who will listen to this on the radio, I apologize for my voice, but I think that's part of Central New York, too. Reverend Luck may be one of the people who gets bored with this presentation because at least two-thirds of it he's heard in class and discussed in great detail and could give the lecture himself. But momentarily, I'll talk about Haiti, and of course that tragedy hadn't happened when we had that class. But thank you for inviting me, and I'm always glad to be here, and for the invigorating discussion that takes place. Sandra asked me if I'd talk about humanitarian aid and with highlighting Haiti, and I thought that I would put a presentation together talking about how the international community deals with humanitarian crises. And I'll start with Haiti because it's in the news and we're all familiar with some of the things that are going on there, and then move into North Korea and Afghanistan, also who are in the news. But in both of those cases, I was intimately involved with my organization, the World Food Program, in working there during my tenure during the 90s and early 2000s. So if we start with Haiti and what is going on there, and we all know what happened with the earthquake how it affected this small half of an island or part of an island, and in particular how it affected the people in the capital and around the capital, Port-au-Prince. There are about 3 million people in Haiti. So the numbers of killed over 217,000 and wounded over 300,000 are obviously very dramatic in a country that small. There are still, according to the UN, 383 people who are missing. I frankly found that to be, comparatively speaking, a relatively small number, given that there still must be many people buried under the rubble. Of course, many people went to other settlements and are living somehow outside of Port-au-Prince. People died in the earthquake because of, first of all, the poverty, the lack of existing resources, the weak infrastructure, the dense urban environment. It was pointed out by a couple of commentators after the earthquake that San Francisco 15 years ago or so had an earthquake of similar magnitude, and less than 100 people died. Of course, their structures are built to withstand earthquakes, and they have an infrastructure beyond the structure of the buildings to deal with victims of natural disasters or other disasters. And these are things that just do not occur in Haiti, the poorest country in our hemisphere. When we look at, okay, what happened now, here's an earthquake, how do we react? A lot of different organizations react. The chart, there's so many that they're relatively small on this chart, but essentially non-governmental organizations like CARE or Save the Children or Oxfam or others immediately jump into action mode, as do the UN agencies, and the ones that are most active in such matters are usually UNICEF and the World Food Program, although there are many others who give different kinds of advice. The UN essentially has a humanitarian office called Office of Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs based in New York with a sub-office in Geneva, and they supervise the coordination of this mass of organizations who want to be involved in helping in the crisis. And they also establish a person on the ground in Haiti, for instance, to be the humanitarian coordinator. Now, for a country like Haiti, when it's not in this crisis, would have a lead UN person, a UN resident coordinator that would try to coordinate all the different UN entities. But when this strikes, then they either send a new person there with expertise in humanitarian work or give this person already there a new hat to say, all right, now it's your responsibility to try to kind of herd the cats and make sure everybody is all contributing in the same in not overlapping and working together to be sure that the right kinds of materials and goods are getting to the right people. And they start first by doing an assessment, and they do an immediate assessment. As soon as the earthquake happens, they send some of their own staff out just to say, what do we need tomorrow? And for tomorrow, they use whatever they can find already in storage if that hasn't been ruined. Second tier is finding anything that's very close in the region that they can get there. In this case, goods that could be driven over the border from the Dominican Republic would be the fastest, or others that could be sent by ship from neighboring islands. And then, of course, a lot of things were flown in, which is the most expensive way to get goods in. But in the case of a huge problem of this magnitude, a lot of goods would have to be flown in. That causes another problem as well, though, because somebody has to manage the airport, and the Haitian authorities aren't going to be in a position to be able to manage the airport and all everything coming in. So in this case, ultimately the U.S. military went in to manage the airport. And you may remember there were discussions about, we can't get humanitarian goods in, there's all these military guys there. It's given that once the military takes over the airport, they have to sort themselves out first. They bring their assets in first so that they have on the ground what they need in order to organize everything else. So then once they do that, then they bring in the humanitarian actors and their goods as quickly as possible. In any event, what the UN does is another too small chart for those in the room, but let me tell you, just generally speaking, what the UN does has is clusters. So they have an agriculture cluster, a camp coordination cluster for the people that end up in camps, a early recovery cluster, you know, how can we, which translated is, how can we organize some of our programs now so that they'll help in the future in terms of rebuilding. Education cluster, a shelter cluster, emergency telecommunications, food, health, logistics, nutrition, protection, water, sanitation, and hygiene. So this is one of the efforts that the UN makes to say, let's get together every organization that's working on these different things. Otherwise, you put organizations together in the same room, and they may not be working on the same programs. But everybody who's working on agriculture, for instance, should be in the same room talking about the entirety of the country of Haiti, particularly the area that was affected or the area where people are moving to that were affected. What are we doing about agriculture? What are the NGOs doing, the non-governmental organizations? What is the UN doing, the Food and Agriculture Organization? Who else is involved in trying to help, first of all, deal with the immediate needs of the crisis, and second of all, rebuild capacity? In this case, of course, one of the issues is where there is potential for agriculture production, the needs have to be met very quickly for seeds, for instance, or they'll miss the next harvest season. So they have to think beyond even feeding the people sitting in front of them, but how are they going to feed them in 6 months? One example, this is what World Food Program... Sorry, I wasn't paying attention. That's what I was just talking about. Can we switch to the World Food Program? This is an example of where World Food Program organized its distribution points around the affected area. And you may have read that there were issues about food distribution. You know, at the very beginning, when people are very desperate for food, when groups come in and say, oh, we have food, and they bring in this truck, well, often the trucks get attacked, not by people with guns, just by people with arms that want to take the food home. That just doesn't just happen in Haiti. It happens in Kosovo, and it happens after the East Timor floods. It's human nature. And sometimes aid agencies that don't know what they're doing, they'll bring a truck in the middle of town square and start throwing whatever they have out, you know, out of the truck. Well, who's there to get that? The young guys that are pushy and aggressive that can get them. The women don't come and become part of those fights. And so that food distributed that way, a high percentage of it doesn't actually get to really feed anybody. It will eventually, but it'll go to the market, for instance, where the guys will make money from it, or, you know, go to the few people who did receive it. It's a really bad way to operate, and part of that is what happened at the beginning in Haiti. And so then WFP tried to organize, because the World Food Program is the lead food agency, not the only one that distributes food. The Red Cross does, as well as NGOs. So they tried to organize, and they were still having some problems. So you may have read, what they did was they said, all right, we're giving out coupons to eligible families, and you bring the coupon to the distribution point. These are the distribution points where you'll get your food. And by the way, the only people getting the coupons and who can come with the coupon to get the food would be the women, the senior women in the household. Now, the news articles a couple weeks ago about this talked as though this was a great new idea. But as Tom knows, we figured this out a long time ago, because in the developing world, the cooks are women. So long ago, when we said, what's our mission at the World Food Program, if what we have is to give out food, and our purpose is to end hunger, who's going to be sure that hunger's ended? It's whoever is cooking the food and making sure that the family is able to eat, and that's women virtually everywhere. So we partnered a long time ago with women, because that was the way, and we found this with countless different experiences, that was the way to be sure that the food was going to, or to be as sure as possible that the food was going to go into the pot to feed the family, because it is a woman's responsibility not only to cook, but to try to feed the family. And that has worked very well all over the world. And by the way, in order to do that, then you also need to listen to women about what they need. In Rwanda, we sent hard kerneled corn from the U.S. to refugee camps, only to find out later that something we should have known before, that it takes three times as long to cook hard kerneled corn than it does to cook it if it were ground. So we brought in little mills to grind it up, but we could have sent it that way to begin with. And three times as long means three times as much water when water is scarce, and three times as much wood when you have to go into the mountains in the country where you're the refugee, and which means further into the mountains, more forest devastation and more security problems for the women going to do this. And it is a woman's job too. So women are really the answer. And oh, this great new idea, they decided to try it in Haiti. Now it's supposedly working pretty well. In fact, I just read a report of the UN, which was essentially very complimentary now of the food distribution, now that it's gotten organized. But there are a lot of other issues that still need significant attention. The next chart also has too many words, but there's all the countries are asked to donate, and you know, some donate right away. Remember, the Israelis were there right there with their dogs and their recovery. That's their specialty. They're really good at it. Turks were there too, because it's another thing that they do really well. And different countries have different expertise that they bring to bear. In my experience, the British aid agency called DFID, the equivalent of USAID for the UK, is about the fastest moving aid agency possible. When people started moving within Kosovo, and I was at the World Food Program, the minister of the aid agency in the UK called me up on the day that people starting to move and said, we have 3 million pounds for you for logistics. And we said, well, we don't even know exactly where we need what we need yet. And she said, yeah, I know, but you're going to need money, and here it is. I mean, they're really very on top of things. So different organizations have their different expertise, and different countries have interests. Of course, in Haiti, the U.S. and Canada have a huge interest, and France does from days past, as well as other countries in the region. But in this case, so many people contribute. Now, the top countries on this list, or the top item on this list, is private individual organizations. That's you, and that's everybody who donates to CARE or the Red Cross or many, many other organizations that are working in the Haiti relief effort. And then the U.S., and then Canada, and then Saudi Arabia next. Sometimes Saudi Arabia becomes a very big donor, and sometimes they're not, mostly they're not involved. But it's very generous and helpful, obviously, when they are. Spain is playing a leadership role in the European Union, so they're becoming much more of a donor. And the next donor is United Nations Central Emergency Response Fund called the SERF. Many countries give money to the UN, to this SERF pot, so that the UN could use it very quickly. Same idea as when the British aid minister called me. I mean, there's money at the UN designated only for the purpose of emergency operations. So agencies can call and say, please, could you give me $1 million from this for such and such right away? And they have that money available. Anyway, other major donors include Japan, Sweden, France, Norway, Denmark, UK, Australia, Brazil, so forth. And they donate in several ways. They either donate to the UN, to the appeal, because the UN has said, all right, we need this much for food, this much for shelter, this much for water and sanitation, and that's after they do an assessment. They do the short-term assessment for what they need right away, but then they do an assessment for what they're going to need for the next few months, and they put out what they call a consolidated appeal. So donors, although they'll do their own research, and by donors I mean governments, although they do their own research, they'll have this right in front of them as the best estimate from the experts in different agencies of the UN about what's required, and then they'll be able to give. Sometimes they give to organizations that aren't part of that appeal process, and sometimes they give bilaterally, just directly to the government. In the case of Haiti, the government is obviously not very capable, even before the earthquake. So there would be a lot more infrastructure that's brought in that's international that would give, they would support. So when we think about challenges, there's almost everything that needs to be done in Haiti because it was so poor to begin with and because it's been an aid recipient for a long time. It's my view that the international community has to be much more serious when they talk about rebuilding from scratch. And this is a role potentially from a U.S. perspective for former President Clinton as the president's special envoy. Because if he so chooses, and I haven't talked to him about this and don't know exactly where he's going with it, but he could be a catalyst to bring together a lot of discussion about how do we start over and how do we help the Haitians start over. And how do we help them build their structure, starting with the legal framework of the country, in order to help work their way out of poverty and, oh, by the way, out of the devastation of the earthquake. So moving to North Korea, if we look at the map first of North Korea, just to remind you, they really have borders with three countries. Of course, major borders on the north with China and on the south with the Republic of Korea, South Korea. North Korea's official name is Democratic People's Republic of Korea, DPRK, and South Korea is Republic of Korea. But anyway, then they have a very small border on the north with Russia. Of course, since they're just across the Sea of Japan from Japan, and of course because the U.S. has a vested interest in that country and still has troops in along the DMZ and in South Korea, the Americans have a big interest in this too. Thus, the six-party talks that are going on to try to deal with the nuclear issues in North Korea. So the six parties are North and South Korea, Japan, China, the U.S., and Russia. Next slide. North Korea is very desolate place. As you recall, this was one country, North and South Korea, 60 years ago. And at that time, the South was more of the agricultural production area. The North was more of the industrial production area. The North is more mountainous, more hilly. Even if the North had all the modern agricultural practices possible, it wouldn't be self-sufficient in growing its own food. And but it does, and it doesn't have modern agricultural practices. I don't know if you can see, I'm sure you can understand that agriculture is mostly manual, and sometimes they have oxen. There's an oxen with a cart in this photo. On very rare occasions, somebody has a tractor, but they're old, either North Korean or Russian or Chinese-built tractors. There's no more parts, and there's no fuel. So we get back to manual labor. Now, think about North and South Korea all being one country at one point, 60 years ago, and think about the fact that with the South being primarily agricultural at the time and the North industrial, the North was actually better off than the South. And the South, in fact, was very poor after the war and was also devastated after the war. And the South spent a lot of time rebuilding, and starting in about 1970, the South really took off and have now become a member of the OECD, a donor group, a big trader in the international world. And if you look at the GDP comparison, it's almost scary. If you take a look on Google Maps and Google the Korean Peninsula, has anybody ever done that? You can see the lights, the bright lights from the satellite in the South. And in China, and almost nothing in between. Also, we think about it from a nutritional perspective. Again, the Korean people are all one people, no matter which country they live in. But now there have been reports out about studying the heights of Koreans from the South and from the North, and South Koreans are now taller than North Koreans. Why? Because South Koreans are adequately fed when they are infants and toddlers. North Koreans generally are not. And we've seen this over and over again. You know, the stereotypic pictures of Japanese before World War II were generally short. Japanese aren't short anymore. In Europe, the Dutch and the British are much taller now than they were before the war. So, it has to do with having the right kind of nutrition when you're young. But in North Korea, agriculture is still important, but it is manual, and this guy is lucky enough to have two oxen to help him. There's a couple of pictures here of manual labor, just many people who are, since it's a socialist country, people do what the government tells them to do. They live where the government tells them to live, and they do the work the government tells them to do. So government told all these people they needed to go out and work. Also, in the next slide, it's two slides of people working in the rice paddies, trying to reclaim some of the devastation from a flood that they had in North Korea. By the way, they have bands playing, so you keep walking to the beat of the band and the drum from the band. Full employment for musicians. This shows flood-affected areas in 2007, and I put it up because these were also roughly the flood-affected areas in 2004 and 2005 and whenever there's a flood. This is the agricultural area of North Korea. It's the non-mountainous area of North Korea. It's the only place where they can really grow much. But since the hills all around have long ago been deforested and never replanted, the floods are worse because of a flood. I mean, their climate is roughly similar to ours. And so when it rains and or when the snow goes away, everything just rolls down the hills and ruins the agricultural land. I mean, imagine that on going down Route 81, if there were no trees on either sides of those hills and everything, all the water and the mud just came down into the valley. That is what happens there in large part. The next slide. I want to walk through because this shows how you decide how much food aid a country needs. And roughly speaking, this is what happens. First of all, what's the basic food need of the country? you end up multiplying the population of the country, in this case North Korea was almost 24 million people, by the amount of kilocalories per day per person for the basic UN minimum level, which is 2,100 kilocalories per day. And then multiply that by 365, and you get the annual need, minimum need, for the country. So that's how, in any of these countries, when there's a big devastation, how we start trying to do an assessment of what's necessary. From that total of need, then you subtract what's the domestic supply, how much is being grown in the country, how much is being imported, what do they have left over from last year, and then also you subtract what the needs are for use that are not going to be used for actually human consumption for other needs. And then you also subtract the bilateral assistance. So what is the coming in from other governments? In the case of North Korea, they for so long had major support every year in terms of in-kind food aid from China and the USSR. So their real food crisis started in 1994, approximately, when after 1991 they stopped getting their resources from the USSR, which stopped existing. So their cupboards started to be bare. And unless you're a farmer in North Korea, the way you get your food is you go to the county office and you get your allocation of food for the month. And so if all of a sudden the cupboards have less and less in it, the way the North Korean government dealt with it was, would like say, well, you know, North Koreans are strong. We don't need as much food this month as we did last month. And we don't need as much food this year as we did last year. And so you just get less and less food because they just don't have it. So that's why in the mid-90s, when we finally found out that there was this huge crisis going on, it was mainly because of the loss of the Soviet aid, and because obviously they weren't producing enough themselves anyway, but that had been a constant. Anyway, you subtract the bilateral aid coming in, and then you come up with what's the required needs. What do we now need for food aid, and how much of it could be provided by the international community? And the next chart shows how much World Food Program has been providing. Actually, we started in 95 when one of those floods with a small amount. 96 it grew, and by 97 we ended up with quite a big program in North Korea. This chart starts in 98 with almost a million tons, and you can see went up quite dramatically. But by 2006, the government said, North Korean government said, thank you very much for all your food aid. We're really happy to have had it. And we're okay now, thank you. We don't need it anymore. So everybody said, okay, they don't need it anymore. And only a small amount was raised to go into the country. Now, they're still very precarious, and it's now getting worse, and I'll come back to that in a minute. But one of the reasons why this happened was that South Korea has essentially replaced Russia as a big donor of bilateral food. So some of the new, starting with President Kim Dae-jung, who had a sunshine policy to let's be more open in the south to the north, they started with many different things, and one of them was more food aid. So essentially they have now a fair amount of food aid, still from China, but also from their brothers and sisters and cousins in South Korea. Therefore, less need. However, there's still, and I don't think this chart does it justice. My point here is that this year, only 12% of the needs have actually been donated by donors for what is essentially expected to be needs in North Korea. Now, we all know some of the reasons for that. And that's all the discussion, back to the six-party talks and the discussion about whether or not countries are happy with the progress that North Korea has made. But we have to remember the children and one of the reasons why all these programs are important. And I remember the first time I had a big press conference in Beijing after we increased our program in North Korea. This was in 97. And they said, well, how could you do this? The reporters were saying, how could you help this communist regime, this isolated people. And I quoted Ronald Reagan. I said, you know, we had a president in my country once who said, a hungry child knows no politics. And it's our job to help keep those children alive. Now, since that time in North Korea, markets have started to open. There were always some very, very small farmers markets in the countryside. But people started to be a little bit more bold in terms of creating markets, and slowly, slowly people would just see a few more people on the street and come out with something to sell. And then people would go across the border in China and get something else to sell, and markets started developing. And for a while, the government wasn't real happy about it. And then the government said, well, all right, let's get in the business too. So the government even sanctioned some markets, and they got much bigger. But then ultimately, it was enough of a movement that the government got pretty nervous about it. So last year, for one of the reasons why the markets were one of the reasons why the government devalued the currency all of a sudden one day from 100 to 1. And so obviously a big devastation on the markets, but then also anybody who had any food or anything else took it home. Not knowing what's going to happen next. Now there's a food shortage because there's not enough internal distribution of food. At least that's another new issue. So what happens in the future? Internal problems include knowing where the food is going, monitoring the food, the potential diversion of food, dealing with the government and the culture of the self-sufficiency culture, that we can handle this ourselves, but at the same time they really have issues that they need help with. And then the external issues relating to the country relations of North Korea with other countries and the nuclear issues. And the country relations are not all bad. As I said, it's really changed significantly with South Korea, which is good news. And it's also had issues relative to other countries who North Korea has reached out to and become and exchanged ambassadors. The UK, Australia, Canada, other countries have now recognized North Korea at North Korea's request. So there's a lot more dialogue going on than sometimes we would read about. Still not enough, but more. I think just before this, there was just a bag of food, which is a picture of South Korea, some of the South Korean gifts. When they give food, they either give it directly, bilaterally, which is how they replace China, or they give through the World Food Program, in which case the food is monitored. When Japan and the U.S. give food, it's always through the World Food Program so that we can try to see where it goes. And this next picture shows people lined up at a food distribution center, and the bags that they're getting, in this case, are Red Cross. This is the International Federation of Red Cross, Red Crescent, because the food comes from different sources, including that. And when food is, I was told one time I was there, I've been there four times, one time when I was there I was told that when the food is distributed in the bags with the Japanese flag on it or the American flag on it, the officials tell the people that it's war reparations. When we were distributing food, we did, as I mentioned, a lot in school to children and in schools. We started in hospitals, too, but we quit the hospitals. And this woman was taking care of her child in the hospital because our monitors could not find real evidence that the food really was being distributed in hospitals. And there's one place in North Korea not to go if you're sick, and that's to a hospital. But we did feed the children in school in the about two-thirds of the country to which we had access. At one point, we were feeding every child in school. Younger children were getting hot meals. Older children were getting biscuits. High nutrition biscuits. So what's next for North Korea? Well, over the long term, they still have these serious food production issues. They also have to look at their own export opportunities beyond selling military items so that they could be able to sustain themselves more. The six-party talks still need movement, and then, of course, changes in the regional dynamics so that all of us, starting with North Korea, can better serve the children. Now, a few minutes about Afghanistan. Yeah, everybody knows by now what Afghanistan looks like. Also, the next slide. It's a desolate place. Of course, it's desperately poor, and beyond being very poor and having a really difficult climate, they dealt with the Soviets for many years. They deal with really bad weather, And then, of course, they had the Taliban. But if we just look at some of the issues, social issues, the life expectancy of birth is in Afghanistan is 43.6 years. 43.6 years. In North Korea, it's almost 70 years. Adult literacy rate is 28%. Women have, on the average, of 6.6 births, one of the highest in the world. And the under mortality rate and the infant mortality rate are the second or worst in the world. They have a huge population, almost half under the age of 15, but also only about a third with reasonable water and sanitation. It needs a lot of work. Of course, the international community is there as well, again with clusters and with different organizations, UN organizations and others working on the clusters. But as I said, after all the other issues they had, then they had the Taliban come in. And when the Taliban came in, they sent out these notices that we couldn't believe in the aid community. And they said, women can't leave the house without a blood male relative or their husband. Women cannot work and girls cannot go to school. We thought somebody was playing a joke on us when we first got this, only find out it was really true. So we really dealt a lot of different ways with the Taliban. The schools we never could figure out. You know, we said we're not going to feed the children in school if the girls can't go to school. And they said, well, boys are important. We said, yes, they are. But so are girls. So you feed the boys and you let the girls go to school. Even a separate school will feed the boys. No. But we were able to convince them that widows would shrivel up and die at home because they had nobody to take them out. They didn't have husbands. They may not have anybody to take them out, and they couldn't go out without a man. So what would happen? So this is what they allowed us to do. They allowed us to set up bakeries in all the major cities in Afghanistan with women running the bakeries, women so designated who could work, and then with widows coming to pick up bread at the bakeries. And they could carry home bread every day from this bakery. And even when the bombing started after 9/11, those bakeries kept going, and it kept many, many people alive. And this was primarily done because we had really brave staff members who got it completed. Well, after 9/11, we go back to the Afghanistan map, we find that we had a lot of new challenges because, of course, the winter was about to set on the country, and if there was going to be a war going on, it was going to be really difficult for people to get food, even more difficult than usual, especially in a lot of the mountainous areas. So we had to look at all areas around the country in order to try to get food in. Our only routes up until that point were from Pakistan. And we kept those, but we went and negotiated routes through Iran, for instance, and with American food coming through Iran into Afghanistan on the west. And we negotiated along with the Americans and others in Uzbekistan to open the border there to allow food to come through so that we could move it in different ways. And I was really so pleasantly amazed at the accolades that we got from different leaders. President Bush invited Kofi Annan and his leadership team to the White House to thank us at one point. Tony, I was in London testifying before a committee of the House of Commons, and Tony Blair, I was called and asked to go to number 10 Downing Street, and Tony Blair wanted to thank me. He had charts that had, from his aid agency, had charts for every day how much food we delivered in Afghanistan since the beginning of October of 2001. And he said, you know, thank you. We couldn't have done what we need to do unless you were being sure you were feeding people. And then President Musharraf of Pakistan said to me, WFP was so creative and helpful, and we expected a lot more refugees on the border that we didn't get because we thought they'd come for food, but you fed them inside the country. Now, we were part of this, UNAMA, United Nations Assistant Mission in Afghanistan, and it's really a very large program and in order to manage the humanitarian relief and recovery and reconstruction programs. They have 8 regional offices around Afghanistan, and, of course, they're the lead in terms of dealing with the government. But the issues we all know in Afghanistan are huge, starting with security. And the security in 2009 is getting worse every month. There's a 65% increase in security incidents in 2009 from 2008. And there's attacks on the aid community almost daily, on people who are there without guns, without any purpose other than help keep people alive and help the community to be able to grow. There once was a time when aid workers weren't attacked and the flag was enough to keep us away. That time, unfortunately, doesn't exist anymore. I mean, to keep away the bad guys. Stability is first and foremost what we need. Security, strengthening the government, and then all the other programs to help rebuild Afghanistan, help Afghanistan rebuild itself. And in the meantime, the social services work continues. It's extremely important. And ultimately, it's important for all the children to be educated, because especially when we educate girls, which is our last slide, then that makes an incredible difference. In every country in the entire world, if girls are educated, they have less children, their children are healthier, they know more about nutrition, they can get jobs, they are better agriculture producers, and their country's GDP increases if their girls are educated. So that's a mission in Afghanistan, but it's a mission around the world. Humanitarian workers are brave and creative. They live on the like the people in the Olympics now who live on the adrenaline of the ski jumps. Humanitarian workers live on the adrenaline of doing this tough, difficult work every day. But they do put their lives in danger in order to do it. But nonetheless, they keep millions of people alive every day. I'd really be glad to answer your questions.
Obviously, the big issue is logistics of getting aid into, whether it's Haiti or anyplace else. I guess the real question I have is, when you have a government, and I guess we start with Haiti, that is either incapable of accepting it all in and coordinating it, or you've got some dictator that says, well, I just want to have 50% of all this for my own people or something. How do you get around that, or don't you even try? I guess you got to try, but...
A situation like Haiti, of course, it's worse because of the devastation of everything, but it's actually in some ways easier for aid workers if there's no government, because then you just do it. It's the opposite of North Korea, where there's too much government, right? So then you have to clear everything you do all along the way. Yes, there are some who, Eritrea, for instance, when I was there, was insisting if we send more food aid that they were going to manage it. We just leave it at the port, thank you very much. And we said no. I mean, Zimbabwe, they say you can't bring aid. They say you have to bring aid in and give it to the government. Well, the donors will not do that. They say we'll only give you aid if it goes to NGOs who are not government affiliated, because the government will only give it out to the people, to their people. So yes, you do have to deal with it pretty directly. And one of the ways we were able to deal with it too is not actually the movement, but the place, the destination, through a program we called vulnerability mapping. So we took the data from the government of all different things, economic data, jobs, agriculture production, education, healthcare, whatever, for the entire country, put it into this computer to come out with a shaded map of the country about what parts of it were most food insecure. So then we can target our work in those areas. And inevitably, some minister of somebody says, oh, well, no, that's, I mean, if it were Onondaga County, for instance, the guy would say, oh, no, don't send it to, inner city Syracuse. You need to send it to Skaneateles. And we can say, no, this is not the place that's the most food insecure in Onondaga County. And it turns out, of course, the minister is from Skaneateles, so that's where he wants the food. But the map with the data from his own government is a great tool for us to say, sorry, it's going to inside Syracuse.
My husband and I were at another lecture recently on Haiti, and the presenter argued that one thing that could be done to alleviate long-term or poverty and rebuild Haiti for the long term was investment in education. And he gave as an example the turnaround in South Korea. We noticed that education was not on your list of things that need to be done in Haiti to secure its future for the long term. We're wondering, is that just an oversight or was it included somewhere else?
Yeah, well, education is certainly it's certainly absolutely critical. I think it's very, very important, and I think it's important everywhere for the reasons I said at the end of the Afghanistan speech, so it's probably an oversight on the slide. But I have to say, I think the most important thing in Haiti is redoing the legal system and property ownership and commercial laws affecting commercial businesses and agriculture and a lot of those issues, which will prohibit any real creativity for even partially educated people. So I think education is absolutely critical, but everything is number one, but the infrastructure of the legal system is critical. Right. So you have to deal from the ground up in Haiti. It's not only poor, it's just got legal infrastructure that's needs to be revamped.
I realize you can't cover the entire world with the catastrophes that are going on all over, but you haven't mentioned Africa, and particularly Darfur, and I wondered what your experience has been there.
I think the international community in Darfur has been not up to its standards that I've seen in many other places. When I was at the U.S., the Darfur issues themselves came out more after I left the World Food Program. I was at the U.N., but I was in charge of security, as Reverend mentioned. And I looked into Darfur from a perspective of the safety of humanitarian staff. And when I did, I found that even after it had been at least 18 months of a crisis, the different agencies had sent very low-level people to deal with the problem in Darfur. Now, part of it was political because all the high-level people were in Khartoum dealing with the people in Khartoum, but sorry, there are still very serious problems that had to be dealt with on the ground in Darfur that can't be dealt with from remote control from the capital, and especially not with the rift between the government and the rest of the country. So, or the southern part of the country. So I was disappointed that we hadn't taken a stronger leadership role sooner, as we did in many of these other crises, and it still has not been adequately addressed.
Another part of the world, Gaza. The UN had a Goldstone report which came out. Both the Israelis and Hamas wanted nothing to do with it. Number one, did you read it? Do you have any sense of what's going on? And then number two, UN facilities, as I understand it, were attacked there despite warnings. Does the World Food Program feed into reports like the Goldstone Report and give their view of what's going on?
I did not read the Goldstone report. I read about it. Yes, normally the agencies would be asked for their comments. Whether they were in this case, I don't know. But I did do a special project for Secretary General Kofi Annan in between my time at WFP and at the UN. And I was his special humanitarian envoy to Gaza and the West Bank in August of 2002. And I visited many areas of both Gaza and the West Bank, but started and ended the visit in Israel because I knew that critically important would be to get commitments from Prime Minister Ariel Sharon in order to make some changes to allow more mobility for the Palestinians. And that was really the purpose for my mission. There had been so many complaints about the conditions of the Palestinians Sharon actually said to Kofi Annan, "We'll send somebody here to tell me what I should be doing." So the somebody was me. And the report afterwards, the Israelis did agree to a series of steps, relatively small steps, in order to help alleviate some of the problems the Palestinians had. For instance, one of the issues was ambulances crossing borders, not just between Israel and Gaza, but even blockades within the West Bank. And those ambulances were just put in the back of the line, and so I mean, kind of what good is the ambulance if it's not going to get any sort of priority? So we did, but the Israelis were concerned. They said, ammunition can be smuggled in an ambulance. So we consulted experts who told us how long it would take to totally, you know, go through an ambulance and ensure that it was everything okay. And then we got the Israelis to agree the ambulances could go to the front of the line and have first priority and be reviewed and then go through. So things like that we've been through, but there are many, many more issues that still need to be dealt with, many, many issues. And it's kind of like, you know, a half step forward and three steps backwards constantly on humanitarian issues in that region. But I believe the only way to do it, when a report comes out like his report or like Jimmy Carter's book, for instance, immediately it gets backlash that it's wrong or unacceptable. I believe that the most important way through that is to spend, whether it's the UN or the US or anybody else, much more time with the Israelis to go into depth about the problems and to work through some of the solutions so the Israelis can maintain their protection of their people, but at the same time that they give space for the Palestinian people to be able to live somewhat normal lives.
Catherine, could you touch about the foundations and how, especially big foundations like the Bill Gates Foundation, how those efforts are integrated into the other major efforts that are going on?
Sure. The foundations don't do a lot on this humanitarian relief. I mean, they do. They give something. So because, I'm sure the Gates Foundation is given to somebody working in Haiti because you almost have to. But that's not their main purpose. They work more on development, which is good because the donor governments spend more time on these emergencies and more money than they do on the long-term development. But the foundations are playing a bigger role in health issues in agriculture issues and in trying to deal with long-term issues, systemic issues. And they've done some really exciting things. I saw some programming just recently in Kenya and Tanzania where on agriculture, where there's a group funded by Gates and Rockefeller Foundation called the Alliance for Green Revolution in Africa, AGRA for short. And it's a new organization of Africans working on building connections for African farmers. For instance, they're working with governments who are supplying fertilizer to some very poor farmers, but once they have fertilizer for a year and have a little bit more production, then they can go to a bank. A bank can get a $150 loan or $200 loan along with the other farmers in their community, and then the farmer, she can bring that back and invest it in her farm, make more money, and get support also from the agro dealers, because the agro dealer is actually the one the bank gives the money to or the credit to, and then the farmer goes and gets exactly what they need. The farmer still has to pay back the bank, but the agro dealer almost acts like an extension worker giving advice to the farmer. And then and the agro dealer's been trained and certified. And then when are they going to sell this? Well, the World Food Program is the largest purchaser of food in Africa, of anyone, but mostly it's in bulk. So then the Gates Foundation gave money to the World Food Program to create a different system so that they can work to train small farmers so that they know about how to sell together, how to work together to sell in bigger numbers to the World Food Program, but to deal with quality issues and reliability issues and so forth. And so there's this whole network building in an effort to try to raise the incomes and the production of food for poor farmers in Africa. It takes a lot of effort, but it's down in the nitty-gritty. It doesn't come in from above.
Thank you. As always, you've given us a fascinating look at the world, humanitarian aid. Thanks, Catherine.